I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
In 1934, Simon Kuznets developed the modern concept of a gross domestic product, which measures the market value of all goods and services produced by a country. Despite his own warnings that GDP could not accurately describe the welfare of a country's citizens, it went on to become the main tool for measuring national economies. Nearly 90 years later, our measures of economic growth remain blind to the extreme wealth gaps and devastating environmental impacts of business as usual. We need a new tool to help guide us on a path toward greater well-being for people and planet.
In this episode, we are speaking with Michael Green, CEO of the Social Progress Imperative. We talk to Michael about his new measure, the Social Progress Index, and how it could change the way we think about economic success for the better. Take a listen.
Hello, I'm Michael Green, and I'm the CEO of the Social Progress Imperative, which produces the Social Progress Index. My background and training is as an economist. Briefly, I worked as an academic, but then went into and worked in the British government for many years. About 15 years ago, I decided that I wasn't obedient enough to be a civil servant. So I left out to go and write books about economics with my old friend, high school friend, Matthew Bishop of The Economist. And like everyone else, we wrote a book about the financial crisis of 2008. It was a book called The Road from Ruin, which was a spectacularly badly timed book because we wrote a book that was trying to be positive and forward-looking just at the moment that the only books for selling copies were 100 different ways to kill a banker. So we kind of missed the timing and the zeitgeist on that. But in that book, one of the things we wrote about was that the financial crisis of 2008 was to some degree, a crisis of measurement, not just about the valuation of the balance sheet of Lehman Brothers, but the very fact that economists like me had been celebrating for the last 30 years how we'd got everything right. We'd ended boom and bust. We had a thing called the Great Moderation of economic growth with low inflation and low unemployment. And suddenly we fell off a cliff. Something must be missing from how we're thinking about the progress of our societies. And so we wrote, so that really got us, Matthew and I, writing about the limitations of measuring progress in terms of economic growth alone. Now, these problems are well known. I mean, the inventor of GDP, Simon Kuznets, back in the 1930s, at the very launch of GDP, he actually talked about its limitations as a tool and urged us not to use it as a measure of welfare of society. But in a way, economic growth dominates because it's so simple. It's a way for us to say, hey, this is how our society is progressing in one single number. Economic growth has gone up 3% this year. We've done well. Economic growth is going down. We're doing badly. And it's also important. It is telling us something about the productivity of our economies. The problem is it's missing a whole bunch of stuff. GDP has got nothing to say about sustainability. It's got nothing to say about fairness or life satisfaction. And it's got weird sort of perverse effects like counting bombs and prisons as progress. So GDP isn't wrong, but it's only part of the story. So on the back of that, a group of us came together and sort of thought, well, maybe we should do something about this. There's got to be some way we can improve the measurement of the progress of our societies as part of our response to the global financial crisis and the effort to build back better.
So it sounds similar to the Gross National Happiness Index. And I think that gained some popularity some years ago to talk about what makes people happy rather than what makes people rich, so to speak. And I think we're all kind of aligned around that. What is the difference between the Social Progress Index and the Gross National Happiness Index?
Well, when we started work on trying to build an index around better management of our societies, we were very much thinking in terms of a tool that would help with very practical decision-making by measuring which policies and institutions would be most effective. And so we were very much inspired by the World Economic Forum's Economic Competitiveness Index. And that provides a very practical guide to countries to say, yeah, if you invest in this or if you change these regulations, you're going to become more economically competitive. That was very much our inspiration. What we found was that we didn't have a reliable measure of the outcomes to measure that against. So there had been various efforts to measure beyond GDP in the past, but they all had limitations. I mean, the godfather of them all is the UN's Human Development Index. And that's a terrific piece of work. And 30 years ago, it was an incredibly radical and important innovation. And what that does is it tries to create a measure of human development for countries, looking at some economic aspects and then some basic health and education data. The problem with Human Development Index and many other beyond GDP initiatives is that they mix together economic measures and social measures together into a single metric. And what that means is that often it's the economic tail wags the measure. So what we thought we would do is to create a measure of social progress independent of economic variables, not because GDP doesn't matter, but if you can measure social progress holistically, then you can actually look at the relationship between social progress and economic growth in a very rigorous way. We also made the decision that we weren't going to measure happiness. So the way you can measure happiness, there's lots of surveys, there's some very rigorous work on this measuring life satisfaction. But we took a view as well that these are distinct concepts. It is possible to live in a happy, bad society. It's also possible to live in an unhappy, good society. But what we're measuring is, are you living in a good society that is giving people everything that they need? We're not assuming that it makes them happy. So Social Progress Index is about, are you living in a good society where people get everything they need, not whether you're happy. We do find that they're related, but conceptually they're distinct. And that's why we're different from measures of happiness.
I got that. Okay. I understand now. So in general, the idea of measurement and the way it affects our behavior is pretty interesting. I guess you are what you measure, I guess, is a kind of a common phrase. Is that your belief as well, that basically the way, if we measure differently, we'll behave differently, or is that something that's just kind of independent?
Look, economists rule the world, not because they're smarter than anyone else, but because economics is essentially the science of choices about where we prioritize our resources. That's what economics is. And so I'm not saying it's perfect, but it is a discipline that helps in decision-making, particularly in government, but also for investors as well. So that's why ultimately you've got to create a measurement framework that helps people to make choices, to make better choices. So that's what we're trying to do with the Social Progress Index, not replace economic measurement, but actually create a measurement system that can capture the things that are being missed perhaps by GDP, to capture the real things that matter to real people so they can become part of the calculations as we are making choices. Because that's why measurement matters. You can't make choices without numbers. And so by putting numbers on things, it helps decision makers informed by economists and other advisors to make better choices.
Yeah, I mean, I always felt like money becomes the obvious measurement for almost anything because it's what we can see and count. And therefore, we go for money because we can't really see and count love or, you know, health, so to speak, right? I want to go kind of dig into some of the facts on your website. And I love the video that you have about, you know, Costa Rica basically using half a balloon of carbon. And you know, the United States has 6 balloons, but they actually have the same quality of life, right? Could you go into that a little bit more, like how your index has allowed us to compare across societies globally, not just relative to economics, but quality of life and the sustainability impact, so to speak, or the green impact?
So to build the Social Progress Index, we built off there's a lot of academic literature being done around this measurement of social progress, works of people like Amartya Sen and Joseph Stiglitz. And also there are lots of international agreements on this, whether it's the Sustainable Development Goals, the UN Declaration on Human Rights. So actually, there's a lot of consensus of what it means to be a good society that we drew together to create a measure. And ultimately, what we're saying with Social Progress Index is, do you live in a society where, first of all, everyone has the basic needs of survival, food, water, shelter, safety? Secondly, does everyone have the foundations of well-being, basic education, good health, access to communication, and a good environment? And thirdly, does everyone have opportunity in terms of rights, freedom of choice, freedom from discrimination, and access to advanced learning and culture? And then what we can do is we can draw data that already exists, and using some smart econometrics that I have even smarter colleagues to understand, we can then pull that data together and create a holistic measurement of how a country or a region or a city or a community is doing. And what we found when we did that was, you know, no surprise really, richer countries tended to have higher levels of social progress. And that kind of makes sense. Because if you've got more GDP, you've got more money you can spend on roads and hospitals and teachers and pencils and all this good stuff. Also, you may be rich because you've actually been able to invest in things like gender equity, the rule of law, inclusive societies that empower everybody. So actually it works both ways, that actually social progress and economic growth can reinforce one another. What we also found, however, was that GDP was not destiny. That at any level of GDP, some countries are doing much better than others at turning that economic power into social progress. So obvious sort of underperformers would be those sort of oil-rich states, which have got huge levels of GDP, but where there's a lot of limits on kind of social progress. But even more, we found how, you know, you could compare how a middle-income country like Costa Rica, but which, however, has invested a lot in its people over a very long time, has a level of social progress that's almost the same as the United States, which is three or four times richer. So this is a really important point, which is that, you know, for much of the things we're trying to achieve in terms of getting the societies and lives that we want, GDP is not the binding constraint. If we use the resources we have already better, we actually could get a huge amount of progress whether it's ending hunger or giving human rights or whatever. That is all within our reach.
So I guess I'm not going to be the defender of the United States in this by any means, but I wonder, you know, when you compare, is it really possible to compare a country like the U.S. and their social progress in a country like Costa Rica and their social progress without addressing kind of the interdependence that Costa Rica's social progress may actually have on the United States and vice versa? Like, is it a fair comparison, or is it something, because it feels to me like the global stage is very interdependent and intertwined. And so we all talk about the U.S. burning all of the world's resources, and it's true, we are very wasteful, no question. But isn't a lot of that also wealth getting spread around, and other countries can take advantage of those resources?
Yes, there's a question about how does the global system work. But if we look where the U.S. falls down on social progress, it is things like personal safety. And we're not just talking about, you know, murder and violence. We're talking about road safety. The US, is, in terms of deaths on the roads, is much worse than most of countries of similar wealth. And that's a very preventable problem. If we're looking at educational standards, they're not great compared to other countries of similar wealth. If you look at, obviously some fantastic universities, but the average performance, because people are excluded, not great. Healthcare. The US is off the charts in how much money it spends on healthcare as a share of GDP, but the outcomes in terms of life expectancy, et cetera, are pretty modest. So those are where we see by measuring outcomes only, we're avoiding value judgments about policy. We're just saying, what about the outcomes? Now, the question about wider global systems is obviously a more complex one. And obviously the US makes a huge contribution to global security, which is critical for economic growth and social progress, makes a huge contribution to the global trading system, et cetera, also benefits from it as well. There's a role there. But in terms of the resources available to it, the United States is doing a very poor job compared to most other rich countries in how it's to convert those resources. And also most remarkably, because we've now got 10, 11 years of data on this, we can look at trajectory. And it is absolutely shocking that the United States is one of only four countries in the world to have gone backwards in social progress since 2011. And I think that includes Brazil and Hungary and one other country. I mean, that is pretty poor. So the US has a social progress challenge. And of course, that is about what's going to be happening in different parts of the country. We do find it's hard to be a big country. Big countries tend to find it harder to convert their resources to social progress. And big countries will also have diverse patterns across their territories as well.
I guess it's pretty hard for some people to accept these kind of facts, right? So it must be, it's very good when you visualize this. And then do you experience a lot of discussion about once they realize, ooh, you know, all of a sudden we are like completely off the charts, we are not leaders anymore, or we, you know, I guess it happens more with countries who are GDP-wise on top level and then kind of find themselves on lower ranking levels, rather than vice versa, right? With kind of, you know, like I think you mentioned Ghana in your video. Do you get a lot of criticism then all of a sudden, like a lot of like backlash?
So we're very clear about this, full transparency around the Social Progress Index. All the methodology, all the data is available publicly. And that means that people, if want to, they can come and give us a kicking and say they don't like something, which has been great. We've benefited from it hugely. So we've spent a lot of time testing and refining the methodology. And also that means going around the world and talking to people and saying, does this look like your country? Does this feel right? You know, and sometimes that means I end up having a row with people about water quality in Luxembourg. But, you know, that is a job. But actually it comes out very resiliently. And my entirely impressionistic experience is that when people get really upset with me is when I say they're doing well. When I go to a country and say you've got, you're not doing well, you've got these problems, people seem to lap it up. But when I go to a country and say you're doing well, they always say, oh, no, that can't be right. But seriously, I mean, this is the point. The methodology is drawing on, you know, trusted data taken from global international institutions. It's using, you know, very rigorous econometric techniques. It's been tested and tested again. We've got a very eminent advisory board. So we're pretty confident that we're getting a robust signal here that really is telling us something about the world. And we can also, and also because we can unpack the data and show where a country is falling down, I think we find, say, for example, in the United States, if we're talking about safety and lack of health and education issues, that actually does resonate with people, I think, about where the US is falling behind. Having some of the best education and healthcare in the world, but too many people excluded from it.
I would like to come to policy, and because your social progress index is kind of reflecting a kind of a, let's say, different value system, I would say, right? Or different values. And how does this actually get into policy? Or what's your experience with that? Is there any impact? You can already say, yep, we have certain changes. Is this an easy way to influence policy? What's your experience on that?
First of all, we'd say that we want the Social Progress Index to be as universal as possible. And that's why we're very clearly trying to draw on things like, you know, the UN Declaration of Human Rights and Sustainable Development Goals, because there actually is an enormous consensus about the kind of societies we're trying to build in the world. So we're trying to make it as universal as possible. There will ultimately be some value judgments within that. So, for example, you know, we, for our global index, would include an indicator around LGBT rights. There is no UN indicator around that, but we think you can't have an inclusive society without that. I'll just have to disagree with some countries on that. But also with any measurement we make, if that's one indicator of inclusiveness, there are other indicators as well. So it's not just one indicator determining that outcome. So we try and make it as universal as possible. And indeed, the thing that has shocked me over the last 10 years of doing this work is how readily accepted it is around the world for two reasons. One, I think just that absolute clear message people are getting is that GDP is leading them in the wrong direction. That, you know, on the back of the global financial crisis, that something went wrong. The rise in inequality and concerns about inclusion are suggesting something different needs to be done and that GDP won't guide you in that direction. And obviously the biggest issue of all, sustainability, that people know that they need some way of trying to manage that and that GDP on its own will not lead to a sustainable future. So we actually operate around the world. So we're now operating in more than 40 countries. So the Social Progress Index is in use in, you know, cities and counties in the United States. It's in use in the cantons of Costa Rica. It's in use in the cities of Colombia. It's in use across the European Union. It's in use in Australia. It's in use in India. It's in use in South Africa. So we've really found across every continent of the world. We haven't yet conquered Antarctica, but I'll have to find a penguin progress index for that one. But we found it, yeah, it's adoption everywhere. Of course, some countries it's not going to appeal to. We know that. But actually, the breadth of acceptance of this has been quite remarkable by policymakers, but also by businesses as well. And you know, investors who want to use this data because they think that ultimately smart investment has got to think about sustainability and equity. Otherwise, it's going to prove itself not very smart.
When you say it's been adopted, the Social Progress Index has been adopted around the world, and I'm so happy to hear that. And is it adopted at a federal level or like as a national policy, or is it really cities and state legislatures that are looking at this as a guideline for their policy making?
So I always think of the strategy of social progress imperative is about two things. It's about credibility and usefulness. So you've got to be, the measure's got to be credible and rigorous, but then it's also got to be useful. So ultimately what we've done is followed the partners who want to use this tool. So let me give you a couple of examples of how it's used. So at a kind of, at a very high level, it's been adopted by the European Commission. So the European Commission has, you know, spends huge sums of money on the regional development of the European Union. One of the big goals of the European Union is what they call cohesion, to help raise up the underdeveloped regions of the Union. They've spent huge amounts of money on this, not to so much effect. And a lot of that money has gone into very basic infrastructure around roads and bridges, etc. So as part of trying to reshape how those funds are used towards some of the more human aspects of development, the European Commission has adopted the Social Progress Index as a tool to inform and guide that policy. So that's a very high-level macro impact with a very high-level institution that is then shaping, guiding, and informing how the European Union is using literally hundreds of billions of euros of aid to regions of the EU. So that's kind of very high level of esoteric. At a much more granular level, I mean, I could take somewhere like San Jose, California. So we've worked with San Jose on a social progress index that measures it down to the level of not just zip codes, but census tracts. So they've got a very detailed local mapping of social progress across the city. And Mayor Licardo brought that then into the budgeting process for the city around whole equity budgeting initiative. Because, you know, as he put it himself, often money is spent on who shouts loudest, not where the need is greatest. So by having that local social progress index data, bringing that into the policy process, San Jose has then done various initiatives around internet access, putting lactation pods into libraries, looking at skills development across the city. Very practical interventions, but guided by very detailed data about the real needs of communities.
How can I create change in my community? No, getting, or can I get access to your data, or do I have to go through the city? Let's take the example of San Jose, right? I don't actually know San Jose very well. So let's say you're in the neighborhood, which, I don't know, maybe
high level of crash data or something like that.
Whatever. But I see how I would like to improve. What's the data like? Can I get access? And how do you actually create that change in the community with your tool?
Yeah, so the San Jose example is one where we've worked with the city government to build this as a tool for the city that then they have made publicly available. So the primary customer is City Hall to use that data and also work across agencies to identify priorities. But that data is also publicly available to citizens who can then start saying, hey, this is where the weaknesses are in my community. Oh, elected representative, what are you doing about it? I mean, what you would also, I'd love to see over time, is people starting to say, to use this in how they get elected. I mean, you remember, you know, Bill Clinton's line, you know, it's the economy, stupid. You know, but when are people going to start making political pledges saying, hey, in my term, we're going to improve the social progress of our community by 3 points rather than their GDP by 3 points. Why not? Yeah, this is where this is, if we're talking about the real things that matter to real people, having politicians making promises and running programs based on that and being held accountable for that, That's what we should be looking for.
Okay, so this is going to be a question that might come from left field, but you know, we think a lot about the monetary system and its impact on human behavior. And while we totally understand that measurement makes a huge difference, there's also kind of inherent design in our money system that incentivizes kind of growth and externalized costs. And, you know, the measurements of money itself is just very hard to overcome. Do you have thoughts about how that system is set up, even, and it makes it very difficult to make these changes? And do you have thoughts about other kinds of monetary design that would help better achieve a high social progress index?
So I'm an optimist, and I think for two reasons. One is I think there's a huge amount that we can be achieved if we stop doing stupid things, and so I think creating data that helps, you know, governments and businesses to not be stupid is a great idea. That's why I'm in this business. So I think, as an example, if Costa Rica can achieve a level of social progress almost as high as the US with a quarter of the GDP, it shows that actually we can make the resources work harder. So that's one thing. I think the other thing, reason I'm an optimist, is because if we look at long term, there's actually not a conflict between sustainability, inclusiveness, and economic development. Because if we go for economic growth that's unsustainable and uninclusive, it's going to fall apart. It's actually not smart economic growth. And that's where I think the value is going to be in helping investors in particular to wrestle with these issues to make better choices. I mean, it's frankly ridiculous that so many of us are putting money into our retirement savings that is being invested into things that is destroying our future and the future of our children. That's just irrational. If we can deal with that irrationality by helping investors to actually better price those factors in, then actually we can have a very big change. So I think we've actually got a lot of the tools that we need already to do that. What we haven't done is joined up the equation. And so we're very excited that investors are actually starting to use social progress index data to help them think about where they allocate money. Hey, actually, this country, this state, this city may have good economic data, but its social progress data is a worry for us because it shows actually that's not sustainable. By investors using the data in that way, I think we can help to start see how the capital moves. So maybe I'm just too pragmatic. Rather than trying to invent some new monetary system, I think there are ways that we can make what we have work better and deliver the outcomes that we want.
I appreciate your optimism. And it's difficult, though, to imagine that if we don't kind of change the underlying structures of our economic system, that any kind of behavioral change is really going to make a difference. And I bring to you my basic foundation of that opinion is that in the 70s and 60s, we became very aware that we were depleting the planet, right? Suddenly, I mean, it was even before that, but it became fairly much common knowledge that in the 70s, if we didn't clean up our act, we were going down. You know, this is not sustainable. It's not helpful for next generations. The planet is dying. Yet for the next 30 years, we burned more carbon than we had in the previous 200 years of human history. And so I'm not as optimistic as you are that if we don't change those profit motives, that investors, when comparing two things, unless they're already kind of drinking the sustainability Kool-Aid and the, you know, that they're already part of that conversation, they're going to go for the best investment. And the best investment with the fastest payoff is usually the one that destroys the planet and isn't very inclusive. And even the ways in which the index is talking about is really ranking Scandinavian countries very high, right? And wonderful policies going on there, but they're also very homogenous countries with a lot of resources and a lot of self-determination. So how, like, Why are you so optimistic? I mean, I don't get it, based on our history.
Okay, so there's two questions. There's one, the technical one is, you're absolutely right in terms of the Scandinavian countries. As I always say, you know, we're trying to compare Iceland, a country of less than 1 million people that's largely homogeneous, living on a giant geothermal power plant, and India is obviously very, very different. Yeah, they obviously got very different endowments. So yes, that is true. And you have to recognize those endowments in understanding, in interpreting the data and thinking what lessons are relevant. So that's obviously, that's an obvious point you've got to make. I recognize that. In terms of the optimism about the future and how we can change our system, I think there are two reasons. One is, I think, because people may be slow to catch on. But I think there is that growing awareness, especially with the environmental imperative. But I think also because of what we've seen in the last year, 10 years around populism, et cetera, a growing awareness that capital is at risk if we don't change our path. I think more people who are actually owning and managing capital are recognizing that it's going to be bad for their capital if they don't address these social environmental issues. And the second reason I'm interested is because so much of the world by capital is owned by us. It's in our 401ks, our retirement schemes, et cetera. And if we all got a bit more active about asking how our money was being used, then we could drive a change. And I think we've become very active consumers in the last 20 years about which brands we choose and which products we buy. I think we're still all way too passive about how our capital is used, especially in our retirement savings. And I think that requires some organization, it requires better information, it needs the choices need to be simplified. But if more of us were asking, how is our capital being used? Those are the big pools of capital in the world. That will change things. And I think we're seeing some movements in that area as well that will drive it. But you know, we can criticize the banks, the investors, or whatever for how they're driving unsustainable and uninclusive practices. But if it's our money sitting in those banks and investment houses, it's our responsibility too.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. But I'm very intrigued about this when, you know, citizens get involved, because I think this is where our power lies. Yeah, when citizens get involved and actually care about the neighborhood and want to not just like be in the right zip code, and maybe the right zip code, as the example of the countries kind of showed, is maybe you're on the right zip code, but actually it's, you know, in your index is rather lower ranking. Okay. And how can then a citizen actually be, you know, become engaged? So can you imagine having some sort of app or something where you're like, I want to participate, like this is like a direct link to my, you know, district politician, or I don't know how it could work, but have you envisioned anything like this already, or what's your future plans?
Well, let me be very clear. I mean, I think social progress index data is the start of the conversation, not the end of a conversation. What we can do is provide the data that then people choose their own priorities. So we're never being prescriptive. We're saying, here's the data about where things are. You've got to choose about how you want to allocate your resources. Just because this is where you're performing worst on the index doesn't mean that has to be your priority. It's designed to be a tool for engagement, to bring people across different sectors to say, where are our priorities? How do we want to work? So an engaging citizen in that, I think, is great. I think that job is actually for someone else. I think it would be, rather than me trying to engage citizens all around the world to lobby their government, would be much better if their government, if the city of New York was actually saying, hey, we want to put this data in your hands because we want you to look at it and act on it and guide us on the basis of that. So we try to work through sort of those kind of mechanisms. What we are actually doing, and we're going to be launching later this year, is we've actually built a national data set for the United States. So we've done city pilots like San Jose, Jackson, Mississippi, Philadelphia, we just released Orange County, a number of other local pilots in the US. But we're actually going to be releasing a new data set that's going to be covering the 500 largest cities down to the level of the census tract. So for the 500 largest cities in the US, you will have detailed data. So you will be able to see how your census tract compares to your neighboring ones and how things work across the city. And we think that kind of benchmark data can really help not just decision makers, but also citizens ask some of those questions about, you know, what choices they want to make and what kind of cities they want to live in.
That's exciting. I'm excited about that. Down to the census tract, that's really micro. So, you know, we can make a real difference there and feel connected.
Yeah, and when we did that in San Jose, what we saw was that, you know, the differences between different communities weren't just explained by economic variables or by skills or employment. It could be a community had everything that was needed to lift off, but what they didn't have was access to childcare, access to transportation. So you actually can start seeing where are the things you have to fix that actually can unleash potential. And that's where it gets really exciting.
I think this was a very nice ending for...
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much. This was really enlightening.
And unless there is anything you would like to add, Michael.
If you felt like we didn't ask a question you need to answer.
I mean, maybe one thing I do want to say, so separately this year, we've done this analysis. When you talked about the balloons earlier, we did some analysis looking at social progress specifically and how that relates to greenhouse gas emissions. And what we found is, of course, is that, you know, because social progress is related to economic growth and economic growth is strongly related to greenhouse gas emissions, that they go up together. But again, what we found was that at any level of social progress, it's possible to produce that with a lot of greenhouse gases, like the US, or not a lot, like Costa Rica. And what it showed us was that actually we can achieve the world's level of social progress that we have today within sustainable limits of greenhouse gas emissions. It is possible. And this is why I'm an optimist, because the data shows us it's possible. Hard, yeah, but we're not asking for the impossible. We're asking for the possible. It's a how question. And when they're how questions, then we can turn to the engineers and architects to solve those, yeah, rather than asking for prayers, you know, or miracles to achieve the impossible. And I'm much more excited when we've got engineering and architecture challenges rather than having to call for the priest.
Wonderful.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that you are what you measure. So what's the first thing you ever measured in your life, Steph?
Let me think about that for a second. What's the first thing I measured in my life? I guess time. How fast I can run.
Yeah, I think that was mine too. First of all, telling time. I can remember very clearly telling time. But also how high I could climb, how fast I could run, how long I could stay up on a unicycle. Like, these are things that I really enjoy doing in life as a kid. And I think we naturally make measures when we do something we like or achieve something, you know, that we want to achieve. We start setting up our own measures. But obviously, when you start running against time, you get faster. You know, did you get faster?
I'm not quite sure if I ever got faster. But running wasn't quite my strong suit, you know.
I definitely got up on the unicycle. I could do that for hours. But it took a lot of time to figure that out.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with you that whatever we measure, it's like, it's exactly what kind of data we're taking. You can basically fake whatever you want, or whatever data you take, you can present facts in a very different way, right? I think there was a saying for this, right? I don't know it in English, but doesn't matter. I think everyone understands what I mean, whoever tapped into that kind of system and or had to present ever, you know, facts. And it was a bit surprising to me when I learned about Kushnet's own doubt or his own warning that society shouldn't take that GDP. It really doesn't make no sense whatsoever. And we had a couple of episodes around this topic already, right? With the Gross Happiness Index, for example, from Bhutan. And I think they are the probably most prominent example of how a country can actually represent or like find a new path or a different path and say, hey, this is really not what Bhutan is about. I thought that was pretty interesting. And it's surprising to me that a guy like Kushnet is actually warning us already, and then still we take this measurement for what really doesn't make any sense for our well-being or is not representative for our well-being at all whatsoever. Yeah.
Do you think that's because there was just a lack of alternatives? I mean, is it often the case that someone comes up with something and that becomes kind of the standard because no one comes up with some alternative?
I think it's like we had this interesting conversation with Anne Snick the other day. We should say, you know, it doesn't make any sense that people from, for example, unions go out and like, oh, purchasing power. But it's so present in our media that GDP is so present. It's like, our GDP went up, or our GDP went down. Now the pandemic, we need to go back to like the old normal.
Buy more,
like purchasing power. And it's like, why? You know, like, isn't it clear? Actually, since the 70s, it is clear that we have a growth limit. Yeah, we have taken our resources.
Right.
We have to change, man, you know, yeah. And GDP can no longer, it just doesn't back up the numbers. It's not a guideline. It's like you want to climb a mountain and you're basically taking the wrong guide.
Yeah, you're not really incorporating what we need to incorporate. Did I say in this episode, this experiment I did on countries, and I ranked them by GDP, but then I divided it by the carbon emission of that country, and in the first ranking, just GDP, Singapore, then US, and then Japan, and then, you know, there was this very common ranking. But when you divide it by carbon, or even the Gini index, which represents disparity, right? When you divide it by those numbers, suddenly the entire chart flips, and all of a sudden you have Ethiopia as the most kind of sustainably productive country in the world. And the one country that sticks on both sides in the top five is Germany. Germany is very productive, but also quite green for its, and quite equal in the income distribution. So I thought that was a fascinating exercise.
It's a nice way of seeing it from a different perspective. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's thinking about like, okay, maybe we need more perspectives to look at this stuff, and really we need to find the right guides, right?
Right.
To bring us to where we need to go. It is very important that we are creating a new index, and this is exactly what Michael Green has done.
Mm-hmm.
And over now, I think more than 10 years, they have been collecting the data, they're like putting the stuff together, and I think people can build on other shoulders. They should. It would be so much easier if not everyone is trying to invent a new wheel.
Their own way, yeah.
And just build on Michael Green's shoulders, right? And the foundation they have created is just fabulous. I really love it.
Yeah.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.